647 Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now is CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Stephen, on these pipeline hackers, we hear that they have identified them as this the certain criminal group, but dark side, what does that tell us? Or do they know the names of these people? Do they know where they are? Is there going to be a knock on the door pretty soon?
Where they are is one answer I probably could give you, and that's we got that from the president yesterday. He believes that some of these hackers, if not all of them, are in Russia. Now, the president was asked yesterday about whether he blames Vladimir Putin for this, and he said there's no evidence of Russian government involvement, but these criminal actors who are trying to extract ransom from Colonial Pipeline and other companies they've targeted are described by the president as criminals, and the White House has used that terminology too. So the president says that the Russian government has some responsibility to deal with this, but he is not pointing the finger directly at the Kremlin. As for where things stand this morning, the concern now here in the East is the idea that this Colonial Pipeline shutdown will result in shortages at gas stations and perhaps at airports too. My understanding is some of the airlines have already announced that it's affecting some of their flight plans because the supply of jet fuel has been reduced. And when it comes to gasoline, last night, the White House press secretary, press secretary Jen Psaki put out a statement last night that indicated that the White House is eyeing some supply shortages in the southeastern United States. Remember, this Colonial Pipeline delivers about 45% of the gasoline and other fuel that we consume here in the eastern United States. So to shut off that pipeline has a significant impact. The hope is that this pipeline will be back online by the end of the week. But as we're starting to see, there are already some supply implications. The White House has said that it's freed up or given some flexibility to tanker truck drivers so that they can spend more hours on the road delivering gasoline and diesel and jet fuel to where it needs to go in lieu of the pipeline.
But my understanding is that there's no way they can transport even a significant fraction of what that pipeline could bring. So you're talking about a pretty serious situation here. And I understand it's the company itself that shut down the pipeline. But apparently they did that because they were concerned that these guys had gotten so deep into their system that they could start raising the pressure, perhaps cause a breach. That's like an act of war, isn't it?
Well, they're not using that phrasing at the White House, but it certainly is. It raises the specter that if a state actor were to take up something like this and do it, that is very, very troublesome. It's a very chilling thought. The infrastructure, the critical infrastructure that the U.S. government helps monitor, is controlled by the private sector. And so it's definitely something that the White House is eyeing and concerned about, something the federal government for cross administrations has been concerned about for some time. But the federal position on this is to say that they advise the private sector as to how best to respond to it and guard itself from it. But you're right. When it comes to the impact on the average American, this is a very serious situation. And you know, we Americans may not have realized how vulnerable we are to this sort of thing. But if you're driving down in the southeastern United States and you go to a gas station that's all of a sudden out, that impact is very real and very sudden.
Yeah. All right. So there's going to be a meeting between Biden and Putin coming up. I assume this will come up. But I mean, we know what Putin's going to say, right? Wasn't me. What do you expect me to
probably
do?
Probably. Yeah, I imagine that is what he'd say. And the president would say, well, we have better information that suggests that you have at least some responsibility for policing what's going on inside your country. As far as where and when that meeting is going to take place between the president and Vladimir Putin, we don't have those details. But the president has been saying that it's his hope and expectation that it will come on the heels of meetings with the NATO allies. Remember, NATO was formed in the late 1940s as a check against Soviet aggression, and it remains a check against Russian aggression to this day. And the expectation the president has is after he huddles with the NATO partners in Brussels the week that starts June 14th, he'll just have come from the G7 summit in Cornwall, England, and then he's going to go to Brussels for the NATO meetings. And it's his hope, he says, that he meets somewhere in Europe with Vladimir Putin immediately after that. We don't know exactly where it's going to be.
All right. On domestic issues, the president's meeting with a group of governors today from both parties. What do they plan to discuss?
Well, the intent is to talk about their best practices, the governor's best practices when it comes to vaccine distribution. And among the six governors the president's going to be meeting virtually with in a Zoom call are the governors of Utah, Ohio, Minnesota, Massachusetts, New Mexico, and Maine. And they're going to talk about how they have successfully distributed vaccines in their states and what the federal government can, and or other states can learn. We've seen vaccine dosing drop off. The concern that the White House has is that all the people who have, or most of the people who have wanted the vaccine have already gotten it, and now the challenge is to get to people who might not want it. Yesterday, a significant development, the FDA announced it authorized the use of the Pfizer vaccine for children between the ages of 12 and 15, waiting on the CDC panel approval and you know, the formal advice to doctors that they can start inject, or nurses that they can start injecting the vaccine into children between the ages of 12 and 15. But the White House is hopeful that this will spark a whole new round of vaccine dosing.
Stephen Portnoy, CBS White House correspondent. Stephen, thanks very much.
You bet.
Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. It's good to have you with us this morning. The governor took out his pen and began applying his signature to pieces of paper yesterday. And with a look at some of the brand new laws that have been signed, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
From criminal justice reforms to eviction protections, the governor signed several dozen bills yesterday, including a Just Cause eviction bill, long sought by progressives in the legislature. Democratic Senator Patty Cooterer explains why doing away with the law that allows landlords to kick people out for no reason with just a 20-day notice is important.
In 2014, one neighbor complained to my landlady that we didn't fit in our neighborhood, and that their BLM and Asians for Black Lives Matter signs made them feel uncomfortable. My landlady, pressed by my neighbor, said she was afraid we were damaging the property values and the feel of the neighborhood, and eventually handed us a 20-day no-cause eviction notice. There was no way to dispute the termination. There was no real way to allege discrimination or retaliation. Without the reforms in House Bill 1236, the individuals I talked to in the communities that we all represent, they're at greater risk of being evicted.
But Republicans argued it was lopsided legislation.
This is slanted towards away from the landlord and the housing providers, and really putting them in jeopardy of losing their property. We can't put such a strain on landlords that they wind up not being able to pay their mortgages. The way this is going, we won't have any rental units left in this state.
If it were really balanced, wouldn't there be some sort of an education component in there for renters? This is what it looks like to be a good renter. This is what you can do to work with your landlord. But there's none of that. It's just more and more demands on landlords.
Cooterer came back with,
this is a resources issue. It's tied to other issues, as I've said before, like income inequality. This isn't about piling on to landlords. They are just as important and they are just as protected. The causes that are identified in the bill, those are at the request of the landlords, and they're right to have them in there. This is where the country is moving, in recognition of all the inequalities that we see.
Another bill signed by Inslee yesterday creates a fund dedicated to helping prevent homelessness in the first place by offering rental assistance. That fund, filled with money from a new $100 document recording fee that will be tacked on to real estate sales. Republicans like Doug Erickson fought hard against the bill in the Senate.
Raising taxes on home ownership and making it more expensive to buy a home or sell a home as a tax increase like this will not help with homelessness one bit.
But Senate Budget Lead Christine Rolfes argued,
this bill is an effort to help solve a problem that, quite frankly, I think a lot of us think can't be solved anymore.
On the criminal justice reform front, Inslee signing a bill that allows judges to vacate certain convictions for those caught working in the sex industry. Democratic Representative Roger Goodman.
To help victims of trafficking and sexual exploitation, and many of them have been put in a position of having to commit other offenses because of their being subjugated by the traffickers. And the bill provides that on a case-by-case basis, the victim, the prosecutor, and the court may vacate the records, but may not. And so on a case-by-case basis, it's important for us to understand that those trafficking victims who truly were in that position of having to commit other offenses against their will would have their records vacated, and others wouldn't. And so the language in the bill is well-suited for this.
That was a bipartisan bill for the most part, as was another from freshman Senator Twana Nobles. that creates special mental health sentencing alternatives.
Because it offers mental health sentencing alternatives, which is a very critical step toward advancing public health and public safety. What I know is by focusing on the root causes of criminal behavior, this bill will be able to promote and improve public safety, and it supports the long-term health of individuals convicted of crimes.
Republican Senator Mike Padden explaining why it had Republican support.
And we have many other therapeutic courts, such as DUI courts, drug courts, veterans courts, and a number of others. And they have been successful, and they operate on the principle of accountability.
Another bill that passed creates a warm handoff system to help those who were incarcerated as they navigate the system when they get out. And one more bill from Senator Patty Cutero that passed was controversial, but it was signed by the governor yesterday. It bars hospitals from prohibiting health care providers from providing health care services related to miscarriage management and treatment for ectopic pregnancies. Prior to that, current law allowed religiously affiliated hospitals to delay or deny medical care if that care was deemed in conflict with their religious beliefs.
So, Hannah, on that last piece of legislation you mentioned, has that actually happened? A woman would go to a hospital and the hospital would tell her, I'm sorry, because of our religious beliefs, we cannot treat you for this?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there was during initial testimony when the bill first dropped at the beginning of session, there was several women who came and shared their stories. One woman, because what would happen is they would go and the hospital would turn them away. They'd tell them they have to go somewhere else. And that delay in care could risk someone's life, basically, was the position. One woman ended up having a miscarriage in the bathroom. She shared her story after being turned away at a hospital. So that won't be able to happen anymore.
Well, wouldn't that be a huge malpractice liability for hospitals that do that?
No, because the current law did state that they left open for those with the religious affiliations that protection to not have to do that, because it kind of borders in there on the abortion area, and they don't provide that kind of service, right? And they have that religious umbrella.
Some medications used to resolve ectopic pregnancies are also associated with abortion. So, in my case, when I suffered an ectopic pregnancy, I called my insurance to make sure it would be covered, because I didn't want to suddenly get a bill. Once you have an ectopic pregnancy, there's nothing you can do about it. The embryo is stuck in the fallopian tube. So you have to either remove the fallopian tube or take an injection of medication associated with abortion to dissolve the fetal tissue. But if your insurance company is owned by a religious institution, they may call that abortion and charge you for that medication.
I thought there were exceptions when it would cause a medical problem, because this is a serious medical problem, right?
In so many cases with women's lives, the baby comes first. That's what the fight is all about. Do women have a choice to do what they need to do with an embryo in their body if their life is at risk? Some people say no. The embryo or baby comes first.
So, absolutely. Hannah, with this bill now, that is officially prohibited in Washington State?
That would be officially prohibited in Washington State. They can't do it anymore.
And how are these hospitals going to respond then? Are they going to just stop admitting people, or what are they going to do?
There was definitely those who came and testified against that, again, for that religious freedom, but they're not going to have much of a choice. They will face that lawsuit that you're talking about if something goes wrong and they turn away a woman who comes for service. Or even if something doesn't go wrong, they will be in hot water if they don't provide those services.
And I'm assuming the hospital I went to also has a religious affiliation, but the nurse, being sympathetic to what I was going through, just worrying in the middle of a life-threatening emergency that my treatment wouldn't be covered, that she said, I'm going to make sure I put on your notes, life-threatening, emergency, this and that. Like, everybody was working to make sure I wouldn't be denied coverage.
Yeah. One more thing, Hannah, on an earlier story, one of the people you quoted there on this landlord eviction bill warned that we would no longer have any rental property left in Washington State. Is that what I heard?
That is what you heard, and that has been, the long pushback on all of our various restrictions, the eviction moratorium, various laws in Seattle, that they would push people out of the market, your homeowners who rent out to other people. That is happening, and I will tell you, I will have more to tell you about that tomorrow.
Okay, because it'd be important to know just how real that threat is, because that, of course, would make the homelessness problem worse, I assume, right?
Exactly. It reduces the housing supply, and that is absolutely happening. And I'll have a woman who will tell us all about it on tomorrow morning's show.
Hannah Scott, thank you.
Let's get to the Daily Dose of Kindness now. more smiles for you. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. A golden retriever puppy born without a right paw became the perfect gift for a little boy in Minnesota. WCCO's Mariel Mose explains.
This puppy is a boy's best friend from the day Marvel made her way to her new home in Waconia just a week ago.
Now are we going to keep her forever?
Yeah. All three kids in the Williams family instantly fell in love with this puppy. But it was 7-year-old Paxson who found his perfect match.
Because I have a prosthetic and she has 3 paws.
Paxson was born extremely premature and developed an infection in his leg that stunted the growth of it. 3 years ago, his parents made the decision to have doctors amputate his foot and give him a prosthetic leg so he can more easily walk and move around on his own. Meanwhile, Marvel was the only one in her litter born without a front right paw.
When she was born, we knew right away she has a special purpose.
Barb Felt is the breeder of Rolling Oaks, Goldens, and Litchfield, where Marvel was born. Right away, she had a vision for Marvel's future.
We wanted her to go in a home with someone who had a limb difference.
That home is right here in Paxson's arms.
It's like they knew that they were special.
Stephanie and Blaine love to see their son and Marvel overcome their limb differences together, walking on their own along trails near their home, Dad capturing their matching yet miraculous strides.
The amount of emotions that were running through me at the time, it was just awesome because it was knowing that she was in the perfect place at the perfect time.
Stephanie has already seen Marvel make a difference in the way Paxson shares his own story with his friends and neighbors.
As he's introducing Marvel to kids in the neighborhood, like, it gives him the opportunity to tell the kids, oh, she's missing a paw, she's like me, and like, it just gives him that voice too to advocate for himself.
In Waconia.
She loves me.
Mariel Mose, WCCO 4 News.
7:48, and now from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott. Director Steven Soderbergh's in town to shoot an HBO Max movie, and the notice went out that Westlake Park was going to be closed, and the people shouldn't worry because there are going to be 1,500 actors pretending to be demonstrators, but they're not really demonstrators. And then, G, apparently, the report we're getting is they couldn't do any filming because when you're filming a demonstration in Seattle, it's supposed to be cloudy and wet and cold, and it was more like Los Angeles.
Well, I would love to be a part of something like that. How come we didn't you know would. About that? Yeah.
Well, the call went out. Didn't you apply? They wanted extras.
Sign me up. Now, what do I wear to something like that?
Just Seattle clothes.
Oh, some like Birkenstocks.
Cut-offs, flip-flops.
Flannels.
Now, apparently the new Seattle gear is black jeans and a jean jacket with a Sherpa inside and brown boots. That's been declared the new fashion look of Seattle. Yeah.
I haven't got a chance.
Well, as long as I drive a Subaru, right?
Absolutely. 100%.
Drive up there with a Subaru, I'd be good to go. Have you guys ever been an extra in a movie?
No, I have not.
Neither have I.
Like,
Colleen's
our
television
veteran,
and she knows all about it.
We used to make movies in high school. That's how I started my broadcast career, was at our TV station at Marysville Pilchick High School. And then we would make movies, a good friend of mine and I, and he's now in Hollywood. I mean, he's doing great. But, if you need a certain mood, I guess they can't fix that in post, can they? But it does cause glare issues. So I get it.
Yeah. So, have you ever tried out, G?
No, I wanted to. I was, back in 2000, when I first moved here, I was up in Vancouver, B.C., and I was eating at a restaurant. And I come out of the restaurant, and there was no movie set when I went in. But when I came out, there was a movie set. And as soon as I come out, Lou Gossett Jr. is sitting right there. Yes, in the chair. And I said, "Hey, Mr. Gossett." And so, I didn't have a cell phone or nothing like that, so I didn't get a picture with him or anything. But it was really good to meet him and shake his hand. I was like, "Hey, how can I get in the movie?" And they were like, "Oh, yeah, run along."
If you could recast yourself in a hit movie, what would you want to play the lead in?
Oh, lead? I don't know about the lead. I can do.
Dave to be Doc from Back to the Future.
Ooh.
We've got to get back to the future.
I can just hear him saying that.
Yeah, that would. Let me get in one of those Rocky movies or something, because you know those are my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah.
I could help train Sylvester Stallone. You know what I mean?
So what is it with guys in Rocky? I was just talking with Nick Allard about Rocky on text this morning. Because what is it with Rocky and men?
I don't know. I have no idea.
It's like the Goonies. Shawshank Redemption. Every man in my life has loved those three movies.
Let me tell you, in January of 2018, Colleen, I got to spend like a few hours with Sylvester Stallone. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you guys.
Did you understand a word he was saying?
Well, yes, I understood everything he was saying, but I have never, how can I explain this? I've never been such a big fan of someone in person that way. And I'm glad that there were no cameras around, because I think I was embarrassing. I was such a fanboy that day being around him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Say, on a completely different issue.
What do you got?
Money. We're going to get a Maya Angelou quarter and a Sally Ride quarter now. But apparently no Harriet Tubman $20 bill, because the Trump administration canceled it. I thought that was, of all the things Biden could easily bring back, that would be one of them.
It could have easily done that. Like, could have just, like, brought that right back to it. I'm looking forward to that. I mean, this is one of those things I'll believe it when I see it, right? So I'll say that. And if I had to pick someone to be on a coin, I would assume that maybe in our lifetime that Barack Obama is on a coin one day. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, that could happen.
I'd like to see them split every bill 50-50, woman and man. I'm done with this whole tiptoeing our way up to representing important women in our history. Spent way too long hiding them in the history books and not talking about them. Just split them down the middle. Let, you know, all the men keep their bills, but give 50% to women. We need a Harriet Tubman. We need a Sally Ride. Whoever
it may be.
Same
bill?
Absolutely.
Would it be now,
TV co-anchors?
Would you want it to be like the same, coin? Like, meaning like a dime, right? So it's the same value? Or do you want it to be one has more value?
I'm just asking.
Yeah.
It'd be the first time women were represented with the same amount of money. Just put them on a bill.
Well done, we Colleen.
And just well like done. That, we're fresh out of time. That'll come up on the G and Ursula show starting at 9 this morning on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G. It's been nearly a year since Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin pledged $100 million to invest in communities of color as protests over systemic racism were at their peak in Seattle. So what's the holdup of doing that? Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott spoke to Amari Salisbury with Converge Media, who lives in the Central District and is tracking the progress of those programs.
The $3 million allotted by the City Council to the Black Brilliance Project for their research has been spent, turned into a report with several recommendations on how to spend this money and invest it in Black communities like the Central District. Amari, I know you've been tracking this money and talking to folks in the community. What's the latest?
People just want to know, what's up with the money? What's up with the process? When's the City Council going to finalize this, send it to the mayor, and get it signed? And, I mean, as simple as that sounds, it hasn't always been an easy answer.
And Councilmember Tammy Morales, whose committee is handling this and is tasked with lifting the proviso to release this money, she told Crosscut recently that she felt that the mayor was the one holding things up, right? Morales said, quote, "It feels to me like the mayor has basically declared war on communities of color who are demanding power or who are asking for access to resources." I know you went straight to Mayor Durkin with that, and what did she have to say?
The time for performance is over. It's time to do, and it's time to get that money in the community. I was, be honest, very taken aback by those comments. They're not only not true, they're very inflammatory. And it's time to quit talking, and it's time to start doing. And I am ready to move that money into community. The ball is 100% in the City Council's lap. We just need council to pass the law. So I support participatory budgeting. I read the Black Brilliance Project, research project report. I think there's some great ideas. I think it overlaps with a lot of the ideas we're hearing from other places in the community. But it's time to let the people decide and get the process going so we can get that money to work. I'm pledging to you right now, I'm putting that at least that much money in for participatory budgeting for next year.
So what have you heard from Councilmember Morales?
We've been reaching out to Councilmember Morales, trying to get more information about exactly what the process is. See, what's happening right now is there's a bunch of like smoke screen finger pointing, right? It's like, oh, well, the mayor's obstructing. And then the mayor's like, nah, we're waiting for the city council. And the city council's like, no, it's the mayor. Or Morales is like, it's the mayor. And so, I mean, like, and in the interim, here it is, the black people stuck in the middle of all this finger pointing. And we just want to know exactly what's going on. So yesterday, this article comes out in the Crosscut where Councilmember Morales is like, it feels to me like the mayor's basically declared war on communities of color who are demanding power or who are asking for access to resources. And so I called the mayor's office and I'm like, well, man, are you holding up the process? Are you stopping the money? And the mayor is like, nope, I support participatory budgeting. I'm ready to sign whatever they send over. The ball squarely sits in the lap of the city council. But the whole point is in the interim, here goes the black community hanging in the balance.
Well, here's what Morales said during yesterday's morning briefing at city council.
And in order for this process to be successful, we need a department or an agency that can build trust with community and that can increase civic engagement in our black and brown neighborhoods. This needs to be a community-driven process, not a city-led process. So with that in mind, I'll be introducing legislation that releases the participatory budget proviso and directs it to the Office of Civil Rights to write an RFP and to begin the search for an organization that could manage and conduct the participatory budgeting process. It's important that we get this right.
Amari, I know you'll have much more with your conversation with Mayor Durkin later this morning.
So this morning, 11 a.m., across all Converge Media platforms, our conversation with Mayor Durkin about this $30 million, the process of where it's at, what the next steps are.
Anna Scott, so I'm hearing a lot of talk about provisos and RFPs, but so far what I'm not hearing is wealth building and new ideas for making that happen in communities that have had difficulty with that. But we will continue to follow up. And on Tuesdays, we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. And David, it came out since we last spoke that the Justice Department under William Barr was on a leak hunt and was monitoring contacts of Washington Post reporters. And first of all, were you one of them?
I was not. No, they were focused on three reporters who had been covering the Trump-Russia connections back in 2017.
Okay, so what's the status of that? And is the current Justice Department looking into that now?
Well, we just learned about it a few days ago. The current Justice Department sent the Washington Post reporters notices saying, you know, that in 2020, under Attorney General Barr, the Justice Department had gotten permission from a judge to look at phone records of these Post reporters, and it had also gotten permission to look at email records, although apparently they didn't actually use the permission to look at email. So we don't know if they're investigating that. The current Justice Department is investigating that. We don't know what's happening with it. We just know that it happened.
Okay, and what leak are they trying to plug here? Is this concerning any particular story?
Just looking at the timing, the letters the Post got didn't say, but if you look at the timing of the searches, they wanted, you know, phone records from, you know, certain dates in 2017, and it seemed like it encompassed the beginning of the Trump administration. When, if you remember, there was a scoop every 10 minutes about the Trump administration's contacts with Russia. Michael Flynn talking to the Russians, Trump talking to the Russians in the Oval Office. I think they were trying to figure out who was leaking those news about those contacts with Russia to the Post.
I thought it was, well, it was members of the administration. I mean, every time I asked that question of various reporters, they said, look, we're not making this up. It's coming from people in the administration. Some of it may be coming from the president himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there were only a few people who had the knowledge to leak that stuff. And I think, you know, the most important thing is it all proved to be true. I mean, at the time, there was all this denial, this is wrong, it's all fake news. It all was true. I mean, Trump even fired Mike Flynn, his national security advisor, over some of the things that we revealed. So, yeah, they're trying to figure out who leaked it. I don't know if they did or not. If you remember last year, there was a sort of a counter investigation. Trump had empowered this U.S. attorney in Connecticut to go look at the origins of the Russia investigation and figure out if anybody had broken any laws. That investigation, I think, has not concluded, but hasn't charged anybody yet. And I wondered if this was perhaps somehow related to that.
I see. Okay, there's also, as I understand it, and I'm still kind of vague on this, so help me out here, that there was an attempt to release some of the sealed material in the Mueller report, which explains what the obstruction of justice case against Trump would have been had he not had the protection of the presidency. Where does that stand?
So a judge has ordered, you're right, this is basically a watchdog group had sued the DOJ saying we want the memo from inside the Justice Department where they sort of described what Trump had done and why they were deciding that this was not obstruction of justice and it shouldn't be charged. So far, the Trump administration refused to release that. The Biden administration has done the same. A judge has ordered that it be released, and I think there's some sort of delay for review or, you know, classified review or something, because it hasn't actually been released yet, but it seems like it is on the way.
Really? Okay, but you say the Biden administration has not agreed to release it? You mean
no,
temporarily or what?
Well, the Biden administration, I think, now that Trump is gone, this is one thing that's really surprised me. They have been very reluctant to release things showing what Trump did while in office. In my case, it affects the records showing what Trump did to funnel money from the government into his own pockets. And I think in this case, their logic, the DOJ, the case of this memo, the DOJ is saying, look, you know, we don't like Trump, but there's a precedent here. We think we should be able to keep these kinds of memos secret. And so we're going to fight it on that principle in the theory that probably there'll be some time down the road when conservatives want us to release something this secret, and we don't want to have to.
Really? Wow. Okay. That kind of surprises me, but I can see where he might not want the distraction. All right. So
go ahead. There's a dispute over a part of the border wall down in Texas where Biden is continuing a lawsuit that Trump started to seize some land so they could build the border wall. Not because Biden wants to build the border wall, but just because he wants to defend the government's right to do this thing that's being contested. So it seems like it's more about staking out, you know, proper uses of power.
Okay, the big vote on the Republican leadership is tomorrow, correct? This is the Liz Cheney vote?
That's right. Yes.
I mean, I thought that the thing that I can understand about this is I thought that the Republicans were, at least based on my Twitter feed, the Republicans really hate cancel culture, right? But what isn't that what they're doing here with voting Liz Cheney out of the leadership?
That's right. Liz Cheney has a view that they believe is, you know, is improper to voice in public. She's been saying that Trump is lying about the 2020 election. It's improper to, you know, it was wrong of Trump to try to overturn the election, you know. And so they're saying, well, you know, in the name of unity, we don't want her out there saying that. We don't want to give her this position within the Republican Party to sort of say that stuff. So we're going to cancel her and, you know, send her back to the rank and file. Obviously, they're right. But you know, it just shows that the sort of cancel culture is just a way of saying, you know, we should be allowed to speak, but, you know, we can decide when other people can't. And you saw yesterday the guy who was the trainer for the horse that won the Kentucky Derby, the horse is under investigation for drugs and the trainer was like, my horse is being canceled. This is cancel culture on my horse. So it kind of has become whatever you want it to be.
Well, beyond the term, I mean, McCarthy, wasn't he also critical of Trump? Mitch McConnell, didn't he stand on the floor of the Senate and said this happened because of Trump?
Well, there's a really interesting dichotomy between McCarthy and McConnell now. McCarthy, the head of the Republicans of the House, he's always been very close to Trump, and he's somebody who has always sort of followed the sort of most extreme elements in his party. It goes back to the Tea Party. Whatever the Tea Party people wanted to do, McCarthy was okay with letting them do. McCarthy now is saying, well, they want sort of a more extreme version, I'm going to follow them. McConnell he spoke out against Trump, and he's been pretty steadfast in not engaging in this, not criticizing Cheney, not wanting to let Trump control what the party does now. They seem to be kind of going in opposite directions.
Yeah. Okay, on the vote recount in Arizona, done by this cyber ninja group. The secretaries of state have come out from other states saying, including our state, saying that there is no security there to indicate that the ballots are being properly handled, as in no chain of custody. And what that would mean to me is, just as an outsider watching this, is that what they're saying is there's the possibility that instead of discovering fraud, there is now an opening to commit fraud during this recount.
I think that's right. The reports you've seen from that are that they're leaving laptops open, they're leaving ballots out. I'm not saying that the goal of this was to commit fraud, but you know, they are the security and the amateurism with which they're handling these ballots would make it easy to introduce fraud. I think that audit has just gone downhill. I mean, so last week they said they were looking for traces of bamboo in the paper on the theory that some fake ballots were shipped in from Asia. Maybe they were made out of bamboo. I mean, that's the level of analysis we're dealing with here. And, you know, I guess they're going to announce some sort of conclusion favorable to Trump, but this is going to make it very thorough.
Is there a timeline on this? Because based on the accounts I've read, the account is going really slowly.
The timeline actually is May 14th, 3 days from now. They need that auditorium for a high school graduation, and then there's like a fair or something there. So they have to clear out pretty soon of the county coliseum that they're in so they can have a high school graduation there. So they are nowhere near wrapping up, and I don't know how they're going to try to finish this.
Well, you can't make this stuff up, as they say. David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thanks very much.
Thank you. You can ring my
bell, Rachel Bell. And this is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Rachel Bell, who's been, and you disclosed this, so I feel I can announce it to everybody. You have been giving Goodwill your old running shoes?
Yes. So there's a phenomenon called wish cycling. And I think people do this all the time. It's when you hope something is recyclable. So you put it in the recycling can or you send it to Goodwill because you feel better that you didn't throw it away. But then it just causes more work for others. There's a story in NPR called Goodwill Doesn't Want Your Broken Toaster. In this article, they spoke with a spokesperson who covers the 30 Goodwill locations in New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. So just in those three states alone, they spent $1 million over the last year throwing away garbage that people dropped off, which is a lot of money. That's only for 30 stores. So think about how that extends through the rest of the country. That is 13 million pounds of waste that they had to throw away that cost them that money. And of course, they say this takes a lot of time away from work that they need to be doing. And it costs a lot of money that they could spend paying people because, of course, they try to do good in the community and hire people and give them jobs. So as examples, they say, you know, someone might drop off a broken lamp or one shoe, or this is just really not common sense. Somebody will just put a used sponge in. So actual garbage, but then things like a Barbie head or a Tupperware that's missing the lid. And that's something that I have done before, which I will not do again. I have definitely put in Tupperware that's missing a lid, which I can't use, but I thought, oh, maybe they can use it. Well, they can't. And so basically what they say at the end of the article is put it through your own filter. If you needed something and you went to the Goodwill to get it, if you wouldn't buy it, then don't donate it. You know, why would you want to buy a Tupperware with no lid? So this is kind of the message they're putting out. The other is if you wouldn't give it to your judgmental mother-in-law, don't donate it.
I like that. But the thing is, it depends on who you're delivering this message to. So for example, for someone like me, I enjoy fixing stuff. So when I go to a thrift store, I'm expecting nobody's going to give away the things they treasure. They're going to give away something that's either a little old or something a little bit wrong with it. And that's why I'm getting the bargain price. And so someone like me would be more than happy to come back with a defective thing if they could fix it. But now after reading the article, I realize that's probably not most people. So what you really need to do, and I have to learn this too, you're not the only one, so don't feel bad. It's got to be then clothes that you're tired of, but which someone who hasn't been wearing them for the last 10 years would appreciate.
Yes, but clothes might be the only exception because they do recycle the material. They do have a way to recycle the material, and they do that with, I think they said like 90 or 95% of the clothes. So I feel less bad about that, you know, like dropping off clothes that has stains on it, but things that are absolutely unusable, like one shoe, like a Barbie head, especially,
well,
you know,
Barbie
garbage,
head is
like
a little
things
creepy.
Like that. It is. But here's the thing. I actually find that they were giving mixed messages because there's a ton of articles about this. But then I went to the Goodwill website on what you can donate and what you can't. And there's a whole section that says it's okay to donate one shoe because they said that they have, at least in maybe just the Northeast, they have an orphan shoe program where they sell one shoe to like a bunch of one shoes to somebody who buys them and pairs them with similar long lost shoes and resells them.
Wow.
So in this article, I was very confused because they specifically called out one shoe as being bad. But then on the website, they said one shoe is okay. And then they also said that if you donate broken Christmas lights or, you know, cords from your VCR, that they'll recycle the copper inside the wires. So it is a little confusing because, you know, broken Christmas lights is garbage, but then it sounds like they can use them. So they said in the article that they're having a hard time making a clear line because they don't want to discourage people from donating, but they also want people to do a better job.
Yeah. And that's worked for them because when the other places are closed, right, that won't take your stuff, I know that Goodwill will always take your stuff without judging you. And so let me ask you this. Let me get your judgment on this. You know what TiVo was, right?
Yes.
I had an old TiVo, although it was the second generation, and I gave that to Goodwill. Do you think anybody's going to buy that?
See, I don't think that that matters. You know, it doesn't matter if it's out of date. I mean, for example, like I bought a new VCR a couple of years ago. You know, people want older technology. Some people are collectors or, you know, people have old slides that they want to be able to play or old VHS. I think that's okay. But if it's broken, I feel like, you know, people will kind of sneakily put in, oh, my blender's broken. I'm just going to put it in there. But imagine if you were on the receiving end and you tried to buy it and it was broken, you wouldn't be happy about it. So I understand the bad feelings that come from throwing things in the garbage. I hate throwing things away. It makes me feel so guilty. I imagine the landfill. But yesterday after I read this, I was cleaning out my car and I do keep extra running shoes in the back in case I just emergency want to exercise. And I threw two pairs in the garbage and it really hurt, but I did it.
I know. I'm the kind of guy who feels that in the afterlife, I will be forced to stand in front of the pile of garbage I created. So yes, if I can avoid throwing it away, I will. I think we have successfully conveyed Goodwill's mixed message, Rachel. Thank you.
You're welcome. All in Goodwill.
Yeah. I am guilty of probably giving to Goodwill things that I know they're not going to be able to sell. But
don't they test those things, though, before they put them on
the
shelves?
Yeah, they do. But what I'm saying is it probably wouldn't pass the test. They'd have to. But I always assume, like Rachel did, that they can probably find a more appropriate place to recycle it than I do.
I don't know for sure, but I know a lot of stuff ends up on pallets and being sent places. So yeah. I don't think that they're upcycling. But what they should have. Oh, here we go. You can have this idea for free, Goodwill. Have a Tinker Shelf, where people who love to fix things can go and find something to fix, like yourself, Dave. Wouldn't you love to find that one radio you don't have yet, or, you know, something to help out your ham radio situation?
My friends and family,
you solve it.
I don't know how many radios I have in this house now, because anytime somebody has a radio they can't use or needs fixing, I get it and I fix it and I say, would you like your radio back? No, we don't need radios anymore. We need smart speakers. So there you go.
Well, and one day when the world is coming to an end, you'll be the one in communication.
Exactly. So
laugh.
Exactly. I have all my radios on. I'll be hearing everything, and you guys will be completely in the dark.
You're a ham radio operator, too, right?
No.
Never. See, my husband just became one.
Good for him.
He started the pandemic collecting houseplants. He's got like 72 now, and now he's a ham radio enthusiast.
No, I love the hams. I can listen to it, but I never got my license, so I can't actually transmit.
Oh, it's so easy to do. It's just go online. He got his in moments. And now, he, you know, he's whatever the handle is. He loves it.
Yeah. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.